I hereby institute my American diary. I've just visited with Mr. Everett, the State House of Boston, where the Adjutant General, Mr. Schuller, whom Mr. Everett addressed as General, showed me a Springfield rifle superior to the Enfield. The Adjutant General was big, good-natured, and grisly. Went into the Senate House, 40 senators present. I have today seen two statues of General Washington and read two autograph letters of his. In 1756, George Washington was writing sweetly to Mrs. Martha Custis, whom he afterwards married. He is very polite, but his jokes, as Mr. Everett observed, are somewhat elephantine. Sunday, July 12th. Went to two sleepy Unitarian services. After the second service, walked with Mr. Edward Everett onto the common and so home. Mr. Everett discoursed upon what had led to Lincoln's election, sketching the origin of the Republican Party. Seward was the main organizer of it, and would have been president, but in the Chicago Convention, local feeling ran so high that Lincoln was substituted for him. Lincoln had the better of Douglas in his speeches, and his national reputation dated from his contest with Douglas for the senatorship 2 years previously. Seward knew the South well, and did not believe they would be easily subjugated. Mr. Everett greatly regretted the split in the Democratic Party at the election. They should have united under some less violent man than Breckinridge. I visited the Provost Marshal's office. In this ward, 400 out of 1,300 is about the proportion drafted. There was a good deal of joking going on in the crowded room. Well for them that they can afford to treat it so lightly. For the Conscription Act is a severe measure. Two sons of Mr. Everett and sons of Mr. Garrison and Mr. Winthrop have been caught, as also a young fellow whom I met last night. This, considering how few names I know, is pretty well. No wonder there are riots in New York. The Canadians I have seen are almost all Southerners. I read yesterday Lord Palmerton's speech on July 23rd in answer to Cobden about the shipbuilding. He seems to me to make too much of the difficulty there in distinguishing between a ship intended for commerce and one meant for war. What will he say to the ironclads which I saw in Mr. Laird's yard before I left Liverpool? I think the North will be fools if they don't make a great effort to have those stopped, even if they have to threaten war. I hope that we should not fight on such a question. I'm glad to see the Confederate loan in a bad way. No wonder people are frightened, for besides Lee's army, I don't see what else formidable the South have left, and I think his army must be very much less formidable than it was when Jackson was alive. At Syracuse, Mr. Samuel J. May, a noted abolitionist, treated me very well and told me a great deal that was interesting. He had been involved in the Underground Railway, and says that they used to pass about 200 escaped slaves every year through Syracuse on the way to Canada. These people are all as keen about the war as you can imagine, and the more educated and quiet-looking they are, the keener they seem to be. At Niagara, I met an old gentleman from Kentucky, the perfect picture of old-fashioned America, immensely tall, with a black felt hat, scrupulously dressed in black, and carrying a splendid, gold-headed cane. He turned out to be Colonel J. Wood, who lives near the Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. He told me he was a slave owner, but was for the Union for all that, as was an immense majority in Kentucky. Three battles were fought close to his house, and one of his sons was wounded, but the country is settled now. It astonishes me how much curiosity there is everywhere about the views of the English on the war. Some profess great disgust at the support we have given the rebellion, but most expect that our opinion will come over to their side in time, and this is what I expect. Mr. Lincoln is by no means such a fool as we have been taught to believe. He will leave behind him a great reputation. Philadelphia is only 100 miles from Gettysburg, where the fighting was so desperate just over 2 months ago. But the thronged streets and theatres here don't look at all like exhaustion, and I am quite staggered by your letter and your doubts about the pleasure of freedom in the North for a slave, as compared with slavery in the South. If you really think slavery pleasanter, all I say is you don't know what slavery is. And if you won't read and know what slavery is, you won't believe me who has read and has got a certain idea about it, and also seen this terrible ill-treatment in the North, the result of which is that the black population looks tidy and thriving. Then you are, I say, intractable, and all I can do is assure you of my own conviction and trust to events to bring you round. I am so certain myself of the good to humanity of this war that if the North were not winning, I should be inclined to volunteer myself and have a shot at some of those accursed people whom you are all praising so loudly. Indeed, I have a good mind to do it now, just to show that all Englishmen are not as selfish and ignorant as most of them seem to be. I don't believe one could be killed in a better cause. However, I am going to the West first, and I start on Tuesday. I want to have a good idea of the country before I see the armies in the field. The struggle here is not so much between two nations as between two parties in one nation. There are numbers of secessionists in the North, and doubtless even still many Union men in the South. When peace is declared, those men will go back. The abolition of slavery and of the 3/5 vote will take the wind out of the sails of the Southern aristocracy after the guerrillas here have been exterminated. The contending parties in the Civil War in America on both sides are of English blood. Germans and Irish are mere accessories. The principals in the duel are Anglo-Saxon, and when once it is known who is the stronger, the mass on the other side will acquiesce. The war must go on until the weaker party succumbs. If ever a nation deserved to live, it is the United States of America. Soon I saw a sight I shall never forget. The whole Union army in the town, about 25,000 men under General Thomas, left their tents and huts and marched out past Fort Wood in long winding columns, creeping into the valley and into line of battle round the town. From Fort Wood it all looked like a great review, but it was in deadly earnest. At about 2 o'clock the line of skirmishers began to advance, and they crossed the open space in front of me in two lines. They had not gone far before the pop of rifles showed that they had come across the rebel pickets. The whole army then advanced in two lines and plunged into the wood at the front of Missionary Ridge. The musketry continued incessantly until dark. The great guns on Fort Wood, 32-pounder Parrots, opened fire 20 yards from where I stood, throwing shells on the ridge opposite. Wounded men limped back up towards us, and General Thomas stood watching close by me. Ambulances hurried forward for the badly hurt. The men cheered as they charged. Very soon, a bunch of about 200 rebel prisoners were brought in, rough and ragged men with no vestige of a uniform, but with good shoes and looking well fed, as they marched close by where General Grant and General Thomas stood on Fort Wood. There was a great galloping of aides-de-camp, a hurrying of wagons and ambulances, and the scream of shells and the whistle of bullets. The result of this afternoon's work is that the rebel picket line, including a knoll called Orchard Knob, has been captured. General Thomas and his army are lying out on the ground tonight in the positions they have taken in the valley, without tents and in the rain. Perhaps they will storm the ridge tomorrow. I have been busy tonight rolling bandages for a kind Sister of Mercy here. 131 men are in Chattanooga for wounds received today. I suppose there are more wounded who have not yet been fetched in. This is a war with a vengeance. First thing after breakfast this morning, I went to Fort Wood. General Thomas's men were still right where we left them, extending in a great semicircle, all the distance from the river above Chattanooga to the river below towards Lookout Mountain. Shells were being fired from Fort Wood intermittently. The rebels in force were plainly visible, General Howard's at one point on the top of the Missionary Ridge, tents and men quite discernible. At 10 o'clock we saw a number of pontoons floating slowly down the river. At first this puzzled the spectators at Fort Wood, but it was soon learnt that these pontoons had formed a bridge by which General Sherman's army had crossed the Tennessee River upstream. He now had no further use for them, and we knew he was safely across. I talked to a gunner of the Michigan Battery manning Fort Wood. He was a regular some time before the war. The guns are 32-pounder Parrots. His shells have not been exploding too often. I began to think nothing was doing until about midday, when I was dividing my lunch with one of the gunners on the fort. Heavy reports of cannon and musketry from Lookout Valley made us all hurry to that side of Fort Wood. I joined two officers looking through telescopes towards Lookout Mountain, and we soon saw Hooker attacking, his men plainly visible to us, sweeping round the steep face of Lookout. Close by me was General Grant in a black surtout with black braid and on quite loose black trousers and a black wide-awake hat and thin Wellington boots. He looked clean and gentlemanly, but not military, having a stoop and full reddish beard, the moustache much lighter than the ends which were trained into a peak. We saw Hooker's men fall back once, then they advanced again. After some little suspense, we saw the rebels run round the face of Lookout near the top, and Hooker's line advanced after them, rifles popping all along at the face of the mountain and guns shelling the retreating rebels from Moccasin Point and Fort Negley. An officer beside me with a telescope cried out, "There they are, and the rebels are running." His glass was pointed to the steep face of Lookout more than halfway up. And there, sure enough, just 3 miles from us, along the sparsely wooded face of the mountain, we saw a running fight with the rebels retreating before Hooker's men. Furious cheering started on the Federal right down in the plain near the river, where they could see the action better than we could from Fort Wood. The spectators in the town of Chattanooga took up the cry, and I never in my life saw anything like the excitement on Fort Wood. Of all I saw and heard today, the most impressive circumstance was the cheering of the Union troops marshalled in line of battle in the position to which they advanced yesterday, where they had passed a tentless night and had been standing idle all morning. When Hooker's men planted that large US flag near the top of the mountain, the whole of the troops and the people in and around Chattanooga, who must number some 60,000 at least, seemed to hurrah together. The only man who seemed unmoved was General Grant himself, the prime author of all this hurly-burly. There he stood in his plain citizen's clothes, looking through his double field glasses, apparently totally unmoved. I stood within a few feet of him, and I could hardly believe that here was this famous commander, the model, as it seemed to me, of a modest and homely but efficient Yankee general. I stood next to General Grant for some time. If the battle had been a pageant got up for my benefit, I could not have had it better. Hooker telegraphed to General Grant, saying that he had 500 prisoners, and all seemed to be going well, when rain came on and nothing more was visible. So ended Tuesday, November the 24th, the second day of the battle. When I came in from my walk, I heard that Sherman had taken the northern point of Missionary Ridge, and that Hooker, in the south, had effected his junction with Thomas's right. Tomorrow morning, either the rebels will run, or there will be a general attack on their whole line. It has been a wonderful chance to see war on so gigantic a scale, under such pleasant circumstances. We feed capitally on the Sanitary Commission stores and sleep under a roof every night. It must be seldom that battles can be seen like this. Today, a poor fellow walked up to Fort Wood and lay down and died in front of us. The deaths and wounds are horrible. I never see a wounded man without thinking how wicked politicians are to begin a war such as this. The flashes from the picket rifles on Lookout tonight is very beautiful to see at a distance. But close up, one would see lots of men, chiefly of English descent, dodging about among trunks of trees and rocks, one side in blue cloth and the other in butternut cloth, but not in uniform, shooting one another whenever a chance offers, like Indians. When a man is wounded, he must limp or crawl like a rabbit among the rocks, until picked up and put on a painful stretcher and carried with many jolts down the mountain to a still more painful ambulance. Than perhaps to die of gangrene in one of the crowded hospitals of Chattanooga. One sups full of horrors. It is my opinion that tomorrow will see a very important episode of the war, and that many more men on both sides will bite the dust.